You're listening to the Franchise Podcast Network, presented by Lucky Star Casino. KRXO FM and KRXO HD Oklahoma City, a product of Tyler Media, reaching over 1 million Oklahomans every week. Now, the Outdoor Hour, giving you the inside scoop on the great outdoors on 107.7 The Franchise.
As long as I can remember, I've been drawn to the outdoors. There's something primal in each of us that awakens when we step outside the bounds of modern society and back into the vast possibilities of the natural world. The more civilized our lives become, the louder our hearts cry for reconnection with our native ways. Failure is imminent, dangers drawing nigh, but approached with reverence and tact, the outdoors return wisdom and gain. In both the outdoors and in life, harvests are fleeting, but lessons and memories abound. With that in mind, we step forth boldly together in pursuit of ourselves outdoors. We are nothing more than tree stand troubadours. Welcome inside the Outdoor Hour. Well, so far, 2 for 2.
Maybe.
We had some technical difficulties, but yeah, so far it maybe. Looks like we're on camera.
So far. Let's don't jump the gun here, though.
Jury's out.
Yeah.
Well, we will start off by telling you, you can now follow the Outdoor Hour on Facebook and YouTube, in addition to Instagram and TikTok and Twitter. So be sure you check out the Outdoor Hour on Facebook. And we are on the Franchise Sports OK YouTube channel, and there's a playlist for the Outdoor Hour. So
that's great.
I don't know why you might, but if you're interested in seeing us in studio make this show, you can do it there on YouTube.
I want to let you know, I got a LinkedIn message from someone I absolutely do not know, doesn't live in this state, found me on LinkedIn, saw that I have listed the Outdoor Hour, and they reached out and they said, hey, I just want to let you know, I checked out the Outdoor Hour. That's a great show. You guys are doing a great job.
Tell your mom I said thanks.
It was not my mom.
Tell that.
My mom couldn't find it.
That robot troll that I love them.
No, that's really
cool. And to send me more messages like that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm sure the next one is, can I sell you something? But I'm going to take the win for now.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, take the compliment.
Bros take W's all day.
Yeah, I don't care how it came. Like, you know?
Well, we've got a good episode this week for you. We actually have a guest in studio on camera. And I think it's fitting. You know, we've had a lot of really good guests over the couple of years that we've been doing this. We've only had one that earned the Nomer freaking rock star.
Facts.
And he's back in studio with us today. This is the Outdoor Hour. I am Taylor Maples. I just shot a bear.
I did.
That is the best part of my week.
It brings him to his happy place.
It really does.
Yeah.
The gentleman next to me is Joshua Wildman Stratton.
Wildman Stratton.
Yeah.
Oh,
mixing it up.
Did you know that was happening?
No, I didn't.
Now that we have cameras, I got to surprise you guys with some stuff. We got to get some good reactions for the people.
Goldfish, heat.
You want to hear it again?
I do. Yeah. Big Willie style.
Wild man strutting.
That came to me like a lightning bolt one day. I just said it out loud, and I was like, that would be perfect.
That is fantastic.
You're a good man. Absolutely.
You know, I try.
Yep.
Well, with us this week, our guest, a freaking rock star from your Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, the research supervisor, the one and only Kurt Kuklinski is here with us. Kurt, thanks for being here.
Love coming. Glad to be invited back. The intro music here that's pretty impressive.
We're trying to step up the production value.
Oh, it's coming.
We need to get an Outdoor Hour hockey sweater.
I've
for
said this,
guy. This.
I'd wear it.
Yeah.
And thank you for calling it a sweater.
Yeah.
I prefer tarps.
Tarps
but that's
off,
on
boys.
You.
I've got an old Jofa lid that I could throw on and bring here. Half visor, little eye visor on that thing.
Yeah.
It'd look good.
Let's go.
We might need to do that.
Yeah. Shirts off, boys. Tarps off, boys.
Welcome inside the Outdoor Hour. Excited to catch up with Kurt this week. My favorite thing, and I've got proof now because we are on camera, Kurt brings us research notes every time he's here.
Every time.
I love it. I don't read them until we're actually on air already. So as I skim through here, it looks like you guys have been busy down there at the ODWC, Kurt.
Absolutely. A lot of research in progress right now. Previous episodes, we've talked a lot about some of these bigger projects, pronghorn research, mule deer research, a lot of turkey research. So I just kind of brought a handful of examples of some of the things the listeners might like to hear about as far as what we have rolling for research at ODWC.
Yeah.
I love that. Also love Dr. Chitwood. That guy's an all-star. He is a fun dude.
He'd be a great guest, too.
Yeah. He's a blast.
How have you guys crossed paths?
Through a little movie that we made with Meat Eater.
Yeah.
He's a great social media follow.
Yeah.
Is
he? Oh, for real. Yeah.
Big game doc.
Big game doc. Yep.
Okay.
Always updating, always throwing stuff up. Super cool.
So what are you guys doing? It looks like that is a mule deer evaluation with Dr. Coulter Chitwood at Oklahoma State.
Yeah, so we're a little over a year in. We've got mule deer with radio transmitters that are providing us data on their location, habitat use, survival. And kind of the overall objectives of this project were to evaluate some of those population dynamics and find out, you know, what is fawn survival, what is overwinter survival of adults. And then a second component of this project that's pretty important to us is how best do we survey those animals? What is the methodology and the procedures that are most useful and most accurate for getting an accurate population estimate of the mule deer we have in the state? And, you know, they utilize different habitats, are probably surveyed most effectively differently than how we survey our white-tailed deer. So they're comparing several different methods of trying to determine the population of mule deer and are going to give us some guidance on how best to go forward with that.
What is the methodology for white-tailed deer survey? And then what are they trying for mule deer that might be different?
All deer survey, most ungulates, whether it's pronghorn, whitetail, elk, they're visual surveys. A lot of them are road-based just to be efficient, to be effective, cover a lot of miles, and basically counting deer and differentiating by sex and age class sometimes, fawns versus adults. But a lot of it is it's pretty in the weeds as far as procedures for how scientists go about this, where you have to drive a certain distance, cover a certain amount of distance, and count the number of deer that you see and number of does versus bucks, adults versus fawns, et cetera. It gets more complicated when you get into parts of the world that have less infrastructure, like fewer roads. How do we accurately survey mule deer in Cimarron County when there's not nearly as many roads, and therefore how do we know that we're appropriately covering the right kind of habitat and the right area to count those deer? A lot of states will use aerial surveys. We do that for pronghorn. Send a biologist up in a plane, and they're doing low and slow flights with the plane, counting antelope and differentiating bucks and does and adults and fawns. That might be one of the potential alternatives that we'd have here for mule deer too, but it kind of depends on what kind of habitat they're using too, because if they're in places that you can't really see them very well from the air, then that kind of negates the feasibility of an aerial survey.
Which turns out that's kind of where they like to hide.
Yeah, they hide in that kind of scrubbier, dense box canyon type country, and they're not easy to see.
No, they're pretty good at it, at the hiding.
One of the interesting parts that Dr. Chitwood is presenting in some of his new research is a lot of use of remote trail cams. They call them camera traps in the research world, and they're placing out a motion detecting camera, a set of cameras, and they spatially deploy those across the landscape in a very
statistically sound manner. They don't just randomly place cameras. They know how much area that camera can view, and its view area, what how the actual square footage that it covers, and they use a very complicated modeling and math to say we need to put 30 cameras over X number of acres facing in this certain direction to appropriately cover this ground, to know whether or not we're, you know, actually seeing all the animals that move through here.
Man, it would be so cool to have somebody like that on speed dial as you're setting up a hunting property. Because that's one of the big things we always run into on our deer lease is we'll run anywhere from 6 to 10 cameras at a time at different points in the year. And we try to be strategic, but we're always focusing on a particular scrape or a pinch point or some type of intersection or feature that we know deer are using. But we're also confident that there are deer out there that we have never had on camera. And we also know that depending on the time of year and if we're feeding or what we're doing, we may be pulling deer from neighboring properties. But the thought crosses my mind regularly that there are probably deer on that lease that have just been able to evade us. And there's probably occasionally a really good deer that just sneaks through a season because their patterning does not align with the way we've patterned deer. That'd be really cool to have that knowledge or somebody that has that kind of skill and expertise come out and help us at the lease. That's neat.
And it's for the hunter, for your utility of those cameras, you probably want to be focusing on a scrape, on a trail, on a pinch point where you know those animals are kind of coming through. In the scientific world, it's kind of a little bit different because we simply call that bias to our sampling. We cannot introduce bias. We need to randomly deploy those cameras across the landscape to get a true and accurate count of the number of animals within a certain area. And if we focus on the trails or we focus on the most heavily used areas, we're probably going to overestimate how many deer are actually on a certain piece of ground.
You think if there's error, it's that you're overestimating?
If we would do the approach that a hunter or landowner would use, where
gotcha.
We're focusing on specific areas of known use,
sure.
of a heavily used trail or of a scrape line that we know that a bunch of different bucks are going to travel, we need to be as unbiased and neutral about our estimate as we can. And to do that, Coulter and his colleagues have figured out a very mathematical and a sound way to do that using statistics.
Leave it to scientists to make something like chasing deer less fun, you know? Introduce math into it and the whole thing just...
I think that's more fun.
I mean, if you have enough kind of nerdiness in you, it is kind of more fun.
Yeah,
no, it's
more
really
fun.
Cool.
I
know
fun.
Guys, I'm not one of them, but I know people that will keep a log of when they have deer that show up on camera based on wind direction, dew point, temperature, moon phase, all of that kind of stuff. And there are listeners out there that will fight me tooth and nail on several of those points about the influence they have on deer movement. But I'm making a joke. I do think that the nerdiness of that is really cool. But to your point, Kurt, the difference really is I'm not trying to have a holistic survey of what the population looks like on this, you know, however many acres. I want to know how many deer are going to walk through and when the deer I'm chasing is going to walk in front of that particular spot that I've marked and spent hundreds, if not thousands of dollars curating. So very, very different goals, but it's interesting to kind of see it through that filter. That's neat.
But I actually would argue it's not a different goal. So if you don't understand what's happening on the totality, holistically of your lease, you could think that you're seeing the best deer, and you're absolutely not.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And so
I'm just seeing which deer are walking through my particular corridor.
And because you're not, you know, putting out a bigger net to capture more data, you don't actually know what deer are coming on, how long are they staying, Are they just cutting through a corner that you're not even aware of? You don't have an understanding of how they're behaving in general across your lease. And so I think your survey size is so small that you're not actually benefiting yourself in the management of that lease, or potentially even really managing for success in the deer that you do have, because you only know what they do in that one pinch point. You don't know what they're doing everywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that is sound logic. What do you guys know about mule deer hunter harvests in the state?
Well, first of all, over the course of the last couple of decades, we know that it's pretty small overall. We for the last 10 years or so, whitetail harvest has generally gotten close to or exceeded 100,000 animals every year during, and that encompasses all the hunting seasons, starting October 1 with archery and then going through whenever it is in January that archery ends, including including the muzzleloader season, including the rifle season. So across all methods, whitetail harvest is usually over 100,000 animals. Mule deer harvest is only around 200 to 250 animals every year. And the vast majority of that happens in Cimarron and Texas counties. And there's a few in Beaver County, a few in Harper County, maybe a mule deer here and there in Woods or Woodward County. So, but the vast majority of that happens out in the three panhandle counties.
Interesting.
Yeah, so and that's been pretty consistent. It's something like 0.2%, roughly, of the total deer harvest in the state is mule deer.
And obviously that is way too narrow of a scope to try to use the harvest number to encompass a population. But what does that number mean to you guys as you're starting to uncover some more of this data?
The consistency of that number and the fact that it doesn't vary a whole lot from year to year, from hunting season to hunting season, it does tell us that there's a certain amount of stability in the mule deer population. What this additional data and the results from this project that OSU is helping us with, that's going to give us a little bit broader perspective of which habitats are these deer utilizing, how do they travel, how do they navigate the landscape, how do the young avoid predation, what are the impacts of predators on those fawns. When we start answering those types of questions, we might get to a point where we say, how could we now manage the land to the benefit of mule deer? And rather than seeing this kind of stable harvest and what we assume to be a pretty stable population, maybe we start seeing increase. Maybe by catering a little bit more in our land management practices to what would benefit mule deer, maybe we can bump mule deer populations up. Maybe we don't have to settle for just a stable population.
Yeah, that's great. We got to squeeze in a break here. When we come back, I've got more notes. It looks like some research is being done on the effect of supplemental feeding on mammalian nest predators, wild turkey, specifically implications there, prairie gray fox population distribution dynamics, genetics, and extreme weather on hunting of northern bobwhite populations. You guys had just done a Christmas bird study this week?
Yeah, we were doing a Christmas bird count.
What is that?
It's kind of a citizen science project that's basically going out in a several mile radius circle and counting all the birds that you see. And this has been done for 80-something years consistently. Wow. Across North America, and it gives us a decent look, honestly, at bird trends, songbirds, all birds.
We're going to talk more about that when we come back. This is the Outdoor Hour with Kurt Kuklinski on 107.7 The Franchise.
You're listening to The Outdoor Hour with your host, Taylor Maples, and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside The Outdoor Hour. During the break there, we were talking a little bit about the, what did you call it? It's citizen science?
Correct, citizen science. It's a pretty broad category of novice, non-professional scientists, just regular citizens who have kind of an interest or a passion in wildlife, they participate and go out and actually collect and capture data for professional scientists who then utilize that data to kind of analyze and look at trends.
I told you guys while we were at break that my mom does this. She's a master naturalist in the state of Missouri. And it's just kind of a hobby of hers, but she's taking classes. She has to do a lot to kind of keep up certifications, I believe. She volunteers at a variety of
I'm going to get this.
Places. It's cool, but I'll call her, and she'll literally be like freezing bumblebees so that she can slow down the metabolism to do different counts on things. And she goes and she chases geese around, not harassing the wildlife, but counting the wildlife and doing things like that. But it's interesting to hear from your perspective that is really so valuable, because to your point, apps like the Merlin app that allow you to just identify birds by turning on essentially a microphone on your phone. Mm-hmm. My mom's got another app where she'll like record and submit the data. We'll be driving around Lake Stanley Draper here in Oklahoma City, and she'll record, I saw this many crows and this many red-tailed hawks and that kind of stuff. That data actually goes somewhere, and it's meaningful as a scientist.
Correct. So on a broad scale, all of those citizen scientists who are out there participating and collecting those data, when you start looking at that large of a data set, say for this Christmas bird count, that thing's been happening. I think the first one was done in the 1920s. Now, it hasn't been done consistently early on, and you know, there's a few years here and there where some of those routes had been canceled due to the weather and other things, but for the most part, it's an 80 plus year look at what does the bird population and the species distribution look like for that one small geographical area. And then you can start looking at it more broadly across a region or across a state or across, you know, the entire flyway of a bird that it utilizes. And over 80 plus years, you see trends, and those trends have meaning. They're not so statistically sound that they can, you know, withstand a lot of true statistical scrutiny. But on a little bit less intense scale, you start looking at trends and saying, hey, there has been a decline in these grassland species. And then professional scientists are doing this kind of research on a little bit more intensive scale, and they're seeing the same results. That's pretty meaningful and helps us to put a lot more believability into the citizen science that's being done.
If nothing else, it gives you another data set to compare to.
Correct.
And like you were saying in the first segment about the guys in Dr. Coulter Chitwood's team that are very strategically placing cameras, it helps you capture a little bit wider breadth of survey maybe than a team of scientists could do on their own, because you're employing how many of these citizen scientists to help collect data. That's really neat.
Yeah, it's cool.
That's very cool. What else do you guys have going on? What are you excited about?
Speaking of deploying cameras, so one really interesting project that we're starting, we actually started in July. It's a cooperative effort between Dr. Chitwood's team at OSU, the Wildlife Department, and McAllister Army Ammunition Plant. So the McAllister base is, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 22,000 acres. And they have hosted a controlled hunt, a draw hunt there for a long time. And it's kind of the premier large buck potential hunt for draw hunts, where people go in and if you get drawn, you have to use, you know, primitive archery equipment. It has to be a long bow or a recurve bow. You can't use modern archery equipment. But people shoot beautiful 200-inch class deer off of there every year. And it's just as awesome cooperative effort that the Department of Defense personnel there, they have a biologist on staff, and they manage their habitat for deer and turkeys, and they do a fantastic job of that. Well, we needed a place to site this specific research that was not going to be necessarily influenced by a lot of hunters. We couldn't use one of our WMAs because we can't control hunting pressure and hunting harvest. And what we wanted to look at is how do these small mammalian predators use the landscape? We know there's lots of things out there like raccoons and skunks and possums and all these little mammals. And you don't necessarily think about them impacting wildlife populations until you start to understand their propensity to be very effective nest predators for ground nesting birds. And when you think about ground nesting birds, turkey comes to mind. And, you know, we've had declining turkey populations here recently. We are trying to figure out how these mammals use the landscape, and specifically, how is that influenced by feeders? You know, there's a lot of people in Oklahoma that use feeders. And so when you're sitting out there deer hunting,
buckle up, listeners.
I'm sure you see raccoons, and you see
we've got some Boone and Crockett raccoons on my deer lease.
So, as a hunter, as a deer hunter, you're focusing on deer. Do you ever, when you see that raccoon? Well, first of all, do you like seeing them? Is it interesting to see them come to your feeder? Is it?
I mean, from an interaction with the wildlife standpoint, I don't want them coming to the feeder. But yeah, it's cool to see a raccoon hopping through a tree. I've been there and I've seen, you know, right at dusk or daybreak, a family raccoon's moving, and no different than seeing an armadillo or something. I mean, it's fun to see wildlife, but I would sure prefer have turkeys.
Sure, exactly, and. People, I don't know if they are really aware of just how omnivorous raccoons are. Let's just stick with raccoons. They are so opportunistic as a feeder. When they come across crayfish, when they come across clams and mussels, any food source that's available to them and they opportunistically come across, they'll utilize it. And if there's a pile of corn sitting there, they'll utilize that. Is there a chance that all of the feeders out in the landscape are either causing these mammalian predators to stick around in certain areas more often than they would otherwise? And is there a potential that that affects turkey nesting in the spring? Because if a raccoon is wandering around on the landscape and they come across a turkey nest that's got 12 eggs in it, guess what they're going to do? They're going to eat 12 eggs.
Like all of them.
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah.
They're gluttonous.
So what we're trying to get at with this study is, does the use of feeders, supplemental feeders, does it change the way those mammalian predators utilize the landscape? Does it keep them in an area? Does it draw them from a long ways away and hold them in a certain area? And the implications of that, when you start thinking about how this might affect turkey predation and nest predation, is maybe we need to think about feeding and supplemental feeding on a much more seasonal basis. I understand that it's got a lot of utility and it really helps deer hunters harvest deer. And that's a known, that's a given. Like, we understand that. And I don't think anybody in the conservation community is saying we need to take that away from hunters. What we are going to say, and it's going to be based on some of these results, is maybe we need to think about shutting down feeding towards the end of winter. Maybe, you know, people are probably still putting corn on the landscape thinking, man, I'm doing a great thing for deer. I'm helping them to get through the winter. Maybe you're keeping a lot of mammalian predators around in March, right before the turkeys start nesting, and now you've got more mammalian predators out there to destroy your turkey nest. I mean,
I've also wondered too, like, is it less about, there's probably a part of their mind that's like, oh, I'm doing something good for the deer herd on my lease or around here, but also just this idea, well, if I feed them all year, I'll keep them here. They're not going to leave, right? And so, you know, I know most cats aren't necessarily feeding all year. Guys that I know who depend on corn as part of their method. But man, they sure start pretty early. And it goes, you know, as long as deer season's going.
Yeah, so a lot of the guys that I have learned deer hunting and bow hunting specifically from utilize corn feeders, mm-hmm. whether those are gravity feeders that are just constantly pouring out corn onto the ground, or they're a timed release, you know, that'll distribute it. Typically, no, you're not feeding year-round because it's expensive.
Yep.
And that's a big piece of it. But what we will try to do on our property, and again, I've learned so much in the last month. We had a crop consultant in a few weeks ago, and we talked a lot about aflatoxins, and it completely changed my perspective on we need to be looking more at food plots than we are corn feeders. And another thing Josh can really get in the weeds on is when you're talking chronic wasting disease, you know, just getting those populations together more densely packed, and that's something that you're doing with these corn feeders. But what we have done in the past is we've started feeding protein, like January 15th when the season ends and we're no longer chasing those deer, we'll feed protein pellets to try to help them keep their stamina up post-rut. And again, we feel like we're doing a good thing for the deer population by doing that. That may not be the case, though. And then we'll take some months off in, like, the early summer, and then we'll go back to protein, like, July. And, again, we're trying to help grow big bucks, so produce bigger antlers. And we'll switch over to corn right before hunting season starts. So if we were to put really a window on when that corn is being used, it's probably mid-September through January with – kind of a halo on either side, if you will, of some protein.
Right. And that's really good timing from a toxicity perspective. That the aflatoxin risk, that's happening when you're feeding in July and you're feeding when it's the hot summer months and deer are out there probably utilizing other food sources, so they're not eating as much corn, and then the corn just sits there and it gets mildewy and it gets stagnant and all these toxins build up.
But so of it developing on the ground, but the grade of corn that we're feeding deer is not the same standard that they feed livestock. So there's an argument to say that there's already aflatoxin present in that feed, which is just going to perpetuate. So you create a semi-humid environment of Oklahoma with a longer summer and warmer months into what we would, you know, years past wouldn't have seen. My argument is like, yeah, it's better than July, but is it really that much better anymore? I don't know. Look at like how late our summer rains are happening.
Yeah.
And how warm it still is. Are we, you know, now, yes, there's probably, I don't know. I'm still like, I understand the need for a lot of hunters. I understand the time restriction that most people have today. I understand the need and desire to be self-sustaining. You know, even the most diehard Oklahoma hunter I know still cares about meat in the freezer. That's still a giant motivator for them. You know, I don't know a lot of pure just, hey, I'm looking for the horns, you know, or the rack or whatever. I don't know those guys. And maybe they exist, but I sure haven't run into too many of them in my life.
They're definitely fewer and further between than the non-hunting community would expect.
Yeah. And so, like, I know all of that's important. And I also understand that if you think corn is expensive, go look into, like, plot management and actually turning your lease into something that's a true native-centric property when you're putting nitrogen back in the ground at the right times of the year and all of those things, and you're caring about soil health and you're caring about diversity of nutrients and you're removing non-indigenous and you're, you know, like you want to talk expensive. Mm-hmm. That's expensive. And it's not just expensive in money, it's expensive in time. And so I understand the limitations to that, but do I fantasize about a world where there was no corn feeding period in incidents? 100% I do. Like, if I'm being dead honest, I do. Only because I believe the long-term success of us, not just of as hunters, but as a community, is to restore the landscape. And corn to me is the easy button, opposed to addressing what is actually the problem. And I'm just so deeply motivated by the long-term sustainability of our landscape and the animals on it that I wish there was a realistic world where, you know, we could do those things. I just don't think it's real, though, unfortunately.
A big takeaway from this conversation for me is the fact that you had basically a professional, a consultant, somebody who's very knowledgeable about this.
Yeah.
And that people are willing to use that technical assistance and that technical expertise to manage your land. I mean, that's impressive.
I will say I know just enough about all of this to be very dangerous. But the benefit I have is somebody gave me a microphone and the opportunity to have these kinds of conversations. So I have taken this platform as an opportunity to learn things from people like Josh and people like you, Kurt, that know far more than I do.
And I still have a tremendous amount to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do really appreciate, and I don't think I've ever really said this to you, I actually got asked recently, why did the radio show get created? And I don't know if people really understand this, but like, Taylor's pure motivator for starting this show was because he wanted to bring experts in the things that he loves into a room so that he could learn and be better. Like, it was that simple, right? And then it's grown into something bigger than that, in my opinion. But, you know, the motivation was to be a better steward. The motivation was to be a better hunter. The motivation was to be a better angler. The motivation was to be a better participant in this way of life. And I think that you've done an incredible job of accomplishing that simple goal. Because, yeah, we try to bring people on here so that we can walk out here smarter than we were when we showed up. And you know, that episode in particular, I think that was like a significant kind of switch for you. And I think you even mentioned it at the end of the show that, like, man, this is a completely different way to think about it. And I had never thought about these potential shortcomings to doing it this way.
Yeah, I appreciate the compliment for starters. Like any American, I'm often set in my ways, and I do things specifically because I think it's the best way to go. But Keenan Taylor was his name. He works with Genesis Crop Solutions, and he's a local crop consultant. He came on because of his affinity for duck hunting. And we made some jokes, but I learned a lot. And at the end of the episode, I said, you know, I'm going about this completely wrong. And it started about a 2-week-long dialogue in my Deer Lease group chat of, here's what we've been doing and why. This new information that's been presented suggests that we should look at doing more of these things. To your point, it is very expensive and time-consuming. And
yeah,
we have a school land lease, so we have the land for a limited amount of time. You know, yes, the hope is that we can get that same property again and again and again. But, yeah, to your point, Josh, it's really hard to justify spending money to regenerate some of these native things and make it look like it's a low human impact property when 5 years from now I'm going to have the opportunity to lose that to the highest bidder at a land auction. But it's not our land. It's our turn on the land. And I think that if we as a hunting community really embraced that kind of perspective, we would have better quail populations and turkey populations, and we would have bigger deer. We're seeing that in the state of Oklahoma. I've seen a number of people talk about, man, they didn't grow deer like this when I was a kid, because now we've got people that are paying attention to these sort of things. And thank you again for the compliment. That is the goal of this show, is I'm trying to learn. I learned how to call a turkey in this very room from Bobby Anderson, you know, the volunteer amateur of the year for the National Wild Turkey Foundation here in Oklahoma. This has been a room of learning and an avenue for me to grow. And I hope that our listeners are enjoying coming along and taking some of those tidbits with them.
And really, that's the basis, and that's the heart and the soul behind the research that is done at ODWC. We need to learn. And the more we learn, the more we're able to take the products and the results that come from these research efforts and push that out on the landscape and make things better for everybody, for everybody that uses that land, for all of our users, all of our license holders, for the general public, for the animals. Like, we are curious by nature, especially us nerdy research scientists. We're always asking those questions. And I like listening to you just describe that process for you. In another world, you're probably wearing this hat, sitting in a seat,
facts,
working for an agency as a research biologist. Like, you can see that in you.
Yeah, it's like one, you know, I had this conversation, just like the difference in environments that we get raised in, right? Like, I had different opportunities than my brother had, and like how that shaped my mind, you know? But having this science mom, like, you know, my mom's a neuroscientist, and so I grew up in the diehard data world where she's like constantly trying to be wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Like, really good scientists don't actually want to be right.
No.
There is no right. It's just like data. Now let's go prove that data wrong.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Proving a scientist wrong is not a loss. That's a win.
No, that's a win. They love it. And for me, on the other side of that, I had this like very artistic dad who was like, you know, all into photography and nature photography. And I was like, well, man, I want to tell a story, but I also want to make sure that like it's right. And, you know, that's kind of like how I landed where I landed in life, was these two worlds colliding into a new version of themselves. But, yeah, I think in a different world, like if I wouldn't have had the art side and like the music side and those type of things for my dad, I probably would have just become a scientist,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and it's interesting the worlds that, you know, the paths our lives take, but
we got to squeeze in a quick break. When we come back, we've got one more segment ahead with the ODWC's Kurt Kuklinski, Taylor Maples, and Joshua Wildman Stratton. This is the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
Now, back to the Outdoor Hour with your hosts, Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside the Outdoor Hour, final segment this week. Joshua Wildman Stratton, Kurt Kuklinski from the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, the research supervisor down there. I am Taylor Maples, Matty Goldfish behind the glass. This is our last segment this week, guys, and we've just got a few minutes. What have we overlooked here that we need to chat on while you're still here with us, Kurt?
Two things that I'd like to at least bring up. One, we've got a prairie gray fox research project going where prairie gray fox is a species that was petitioned for listing on the Endangered Species Act. And more data is needed to know where these things live, how broadly they're distributed across their entire range within Oklahoma, and population trends. So we've got a research team at OSU with led by Dr. Rob Lonsinger, and he's using, again, camera traps, remote cameras deployed across the landscape to kind of figure out, you know, how broadly these things are distributed and how common they are. And it's a pretty laborious project that involves a poor grad student, Emily in this case, sifting through thousands and thousands and thousands of images from a trail camera.
On the spotted skunk research, because it was similar motivator, right?
Yep.
They were looking at putting them on the list, and we needed to get the data. Were camera traps used in that
correct.
As well?
Correct. A very similar study design.
Yep. Cool.
And in that case, because we're learning so much more about spotted skunk, there was a decision made by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that did not warrant a listing in
right.
that case. And we're kind of hoping the same thing happens where when we invest in these research projects and they deliver some more data for us, we're hoping to keep these species, keep these animals off the ESA list. Like the worst thing that can happen is for one of these animals, a species, to be listed on the Endangered Species Act list. That it's not necessarily a death knell for these animals, but we know things are going really poorly for them when that happens. So
right.
when we invest money on the front end and really start studying these critters to know what's their true population status, we often find out that they're more stable than maybe we realized, and that helps to prevent them from being listed. So that's a good goal for us. Another project that I did want to bring up is regarding northern bobwhite. So quail populations here, we hear it all the time. It's, you know, wow, what happened? Quail aren't like they were in the 70s and 80s. And you start looking at things like land use and how that's changed, and
land segmentation and yes,
development.
Correct. Yeah. All of these things that have happened to quail habitat across the entire grasslands of the heartland of this country. And it's not just an Oklahoma thing. I mean, there used to be tons of quail in places like Nebraska, up into Iowa, down in the southeast, and it's just kind of on the decline everywhere. Well, a group of researchers up at Oklahoma State, again, we're cooperating with them to look at the impacts of weather and environmental conditions on quail and quail habitat. And we're also trying to look a little bit at hunting. And not that we think hunting is a cause, but we need to understand a little bit better about hunter harvest and how that is different across different WMAs. Is that different out in Northwest versus Southwest versus Central Oklahoma? So these researchers are doing a lot of capture and banding of quail, and it's pretty essential that when hunters that come across a quail that they've shot that has a metal band on the leg, that they report that and provide those data to us so that we better understand hunter harvest, what proportion of our quail are being harvested every year, and it helps us better provide all of the environmental needs to meet those needs of the quail, to know that we're not, you know, dealing with a declining population, that there's at least some stability there, and a lot of this helps us to get at that. And we reach out to our partners at these universities to help produce the data to look at these things and answer these questions, because we just don't have the time and personnel capacity to go out and do this all on our own. So that's why I love my job, because it's so collaborative. We work together with so many bright, brilliant people, get to meet a lot of really interesting and gung-ho young graduate students that are working their way into having the career that I currently have. And you kind of feel like you want to mentor them and you want to give them every opportunity, and they're so gung-ho about this and they love doing their research, and it's valuable to us and it's valuable to our license holders.
That's really cool. I've got a really close friend that runs a few businesses in northern New Mexico. One of them is a little roadside motel. Shout out to Chama Trails Inn in Chama, New Mexico. If you need a great place to stop, go check them out. But they had a grad student, I don't know where she was going to school or really what she was doing, but stayed with them for several months doing some type of ungulate, I think it was an elk study that she was working on. And I just remember hearing stories from that. That's such a cool experience.
That's the exact same thing that's happening on a more local level out in Cheyenne, Oklahoma at the Cheyenne Motel.
Really?
The graduate students from this quail project, they're often, you know, in and out of the Cheyenne Motel. And that's where I take my kids. I'm a public land hunter. That's where we hunt deer. I got into a conversation with the lady at the hotel about the students from OSU coming through and how much they enjoy having those students out there.
That's awesome. Well, we appreciate those of you that are pursuing careers doing this, so that us outdoorsmen and people that have passions for protecting, preserving, conserving all of these natural resources can have those things for generations to come. So, Kurt, thanks for being with us. We always enjoy having you. Hey, you're the first guest on the video version of the Outdoor Hour.
Wow, man. I've been breaking barriers here the last couple times I've been on. I got my own intro music. Now I'm on video. This is great. I look forward to the next time that you guys invite me back.
Next time you show up, we got tarps on hand.
That's Joshua Wildman Stratton. On behalf of Maddie Goldfish, this is the Outdoor Hour. I'm Taylor Maples. You can now follow the Outdoor Hour on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Facebook, and now you can find us on YouTube. Find the Franchise OK YouTube page and go look for the Outdoor Hour playlist there is what it's called. I'm Taylor Maples. This is the Outdoor Hour. Thanks for being with us. Until next time, go boldly. We'll see you outdoors.